In 1852, in a legislative session in Fillmore, Utah, Brigham Young, for the first time, enunciated a ban for African American saints to have the priesthood, and also gave some doctrinal reasons why. This was the first time it had shown up in the church, and it would then stand for over 100 years. How did this ban come to be? Something that we see so abhorrent in looking at it in retrospect, and that it would take a revelation in 18 or 1978 to reverse it. Let's look at the roots and the context of the ban on of the priesthood for African American saints, how it came, and possibly the things that came along to change Brigham Young's ideas on that issue. Join us for a fascinating class as we try and work our way through the ban on the priesthood in the LDS Church.
And welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within its pages. And now, on to the class.
Okay. Well, welcome to our class. This is, boy, I'll tell you. As I've been digging through this, that we have more information now about so many things, and where we have so many church historians and access to materials that we've never had access to, we have a broader understanding about things that happen in our history. And this one's tough. With today's class, we'll have three more classes for the semester, taking us probably to May 19th. And the next three are tough. We're going to hit some hard things in our history. And this is as hard as anything. So, as we look through this, let's go ahead and jump into this. So, all right, that said, I want to really kind of get a kind of back way up and run into the events that led into the priesthood ban that stood in the church for over 100 years. I want to start in an interesting place. So there's two things I want to bring up. First of all, let me ask a question. When we go into the scriptures, it's interesting that very early in the church, the Lord says, "The fullness of my gospel might be proclaimed by the weak and simple unto the ends of the earth before kings and rulers, insomuch as they erred, it might be known." Okay? What's he telling us here?
What?
That the prophet's not perfect. That the prophets are going to do, prophets tend to be at least seen or can be appear weak and simple. So he's not going to get the most educated people, you know, other than maybe Dallin Oaks or somebody like that. And in so much as they err, what's he saying? They're going to make mistakes. They can be weak and simple and as. And I think it's interesting. He says, and in as much as they err, in as much as they make mistakes, it will what? Be known.
Might.
It might be made known. That's right.
A lot of people still got gospel doctrine on their shelf.
I know. I know. Or marvelous work and a wonder. Miracle of forgiveness. But anyway, in as much as it erred, they err, it might be known. And there's going to be often... Because I'm just thinking how many times with Joseph, he, where he's receiving a revelation from the Lord and he's being rebuked by the Lord. And then he goes, okay, that's a revelation from the Lord, so I'm being rebuked and we're going to publish it. Publish a rebuke from God in the scriptures that everybody can think about what would happen if in your life, either parenting or in your own personal life, you make mistakes, the Lord corrects you on it, and then you write down the revelation from the Lord, and then I'm going to publish it where everybody can read it. Well, that's, you know, one of those things that I think about with Joseph that to me marks him as a prophet is his willingness to say, here's the wonderful revelations, but here's my rebuke, and we'll publish those too. Well, that's a certain amount of humility to say, I'm going to put it out there. Everybody's going to know that the Lord says I'm not handling my kids very well, and neither is Sydney, you know. So inasmuch as it erred, it might be known. So they're going to be weak. They're going to be simple. They're going to make mistakes, and we're going to know about it. Okay? And this is the first time prophet has ever said this? Oh, heck no. Look at Moroni. Condemn me not because of what? My imperfections. Neither my father because of his imperfections. Neither them who have written before, but give thanks that God hath made manifest unto you our imperfections. Okay? That you may learn to be more wise than we have been. Well, that's quite a statement, I think. I think that's incredibly interesting that the Lord would say, yeah, my prophets are going to be, we love them, they're inspired, I've called them, they do a great work, they move the church forward, and they're imperfect, and you're going to know about it.
I think there's a quote from Joseph Smith when he was being accused of a whole bunch of things. His response was, if you don't expect me to be perfect, I won't expect you to be perfect.
Yeah. Well, and Joseph said, you'll be saved when nobody has any accusations against you. Which, if you really think about that, that's amazing in the eternity that salvation comes when there are no more accusers. Yeah.
Let me know if this will be addressed later. For the imperfections of man, we get it. But as far as how do we navigate questions from non-members, questioning a leader of the church making decisions for the church, that nowadays we're looking back at the
See, that was right. No, I was going to do that right now. Let's do that. Because if we start with the premise, because so often those have struggled. We were talking earlier about how many in the millennial generation were losing massive amounts of members. And the attacks coming from like former members of the church or even outside are attacking is based on this very thing. Well, your prophet, who you say is the prophet, which means he speaks for God, and then he makes mistakes. How would we answer that, guys? Because that's the very accusation that hits us. We kind of sort of get it, but
what about Moses? Now, he made mistakes.
Yeah.
And they're in the Old Testament. He was the prophet of God, so.
So there's some scriptural background for prophets that make mistakes. David had his moments.
David was.
Yeah.
For me, the question is not so much how do we answer that? How do we answer that? Children can follow the path.
The sticky thing is that, especially if we're in a group of faithful members, we say, well, yeah, follow the prophet, do what he says because it's from God.
Follow the prophet. He knows the way, right? Okay. No, you're asking, and I think this is the exact thing we struggle with.
So our prophets tell us not to do that. Our prophets tell us, follow us and pray about what we say so that you can get your answer from God. And part of the reason for that is because we will occasionally misunderstand what they say.
Or sometimes we understood it, and it turned out that they might have been wrong.
But I'm certain we've been explicitly told not to just take what they say and
scripturally, and yeah, it, those talks are out there.
Have we been with you? I haven't thought that we acknowledge that. And if so, I think part of the process is to that's something that you see that as a final.
I know. Yeah, we'll get into that more next week when the revelation comes. Okay. Yeah. Alan's. Yeah, I think. Alan, it is a good answer.
I have been asked that many times, and I usually become irritated. because he's a human. Humans make mistakes. Yeah, he's not God. He and all of his, everybody who reports to him, with the exception of a very few, are all lay ministers.
Right.
You know, we in the church, you know, yesterday I served all day long and made 12 mistakes.
No,
by the way,
more
I don't.
Than that.
By the way, yes, I said good morning to Jim. So, by the way, I don't care. I just do my best. Now, with the prophet, I think they care more than I do, but they're just damn humans like the rest of us.
Well, but here's the deal, though. Here's the deal. That on one side, we do that. We recognize, here's who they are, we got it, okay? But culturally, do we send that message that prophets are infallible? Are we teaching that to the youth? Do we teach that in primary?
I think it's an interesting
should
thing,
we?
Like
I don't know. Yeah. Well,
there's never a one-fold answer, but my son went on a mission and for obedience.
Yeah.
And my husband was the look that obedience also has a reward. And he was rewarded with not
sure.
Because of just following the prophet. So
yeah, there was a mistake. Okay. Yeah, well, that, let's go out here then, Charlie.
Okay, so the reason I'm really excited about this lesson next week, I really hope I can make it. I had, in the fire department, I have a captain, he's now retired, he was black, great guy, awesome. He questioned me about this topic.
Yeah.
And I had to admit, like, I'm sorry, I haven't done enough research to be able to comprehend. So I'm excited to be able to answer this at least better than I was.
Yeah, you'll have a lot of info after today.
Want to be able to answer the question of when a leader of the church makes a decision for the church that proves later to be not as good a decision.
Right.
How can we address that, regardless of the topic?
And I think we've got to be able to do that. Let me just quickly share something. Part of this falls under the idea that Joseph Smith said something once that by contraries, the truth is made manifest. By proving contraries, truth is made manifest. And the gospel is full of contraries. Because we've got something like faith. Cruddy marker. Oh, that's even worse. You got faith and... You catch it? It's there. You've got faith and works. The spirit of the law and the letter of the law. And there's always contraries within the gospel. And at one point we'll lean one way and one leans into the other. And one of these that we're talking about is institutional revelation versus personal revelation. And you're having to be able to lean back and forth sometimes and lean on one side and then lean to the other. And there was the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There are contrasts that by comparing both wings of that, it isn't always going to be in the middle. We're going to be leaning one way or the other. And when we start talking about prophets and we start saying, I'm entitled and I'm supposed to get my own personal answers, and then there's institutional answers coming to the brethren, and if you lean heavy on this side, you go, yeah, your personal answers are okay as long as they line up exactly with what the prophet is saying. And they say, okay, I'm getting this answer, but the prophet says this, so I have to lean that way.
You're free agency, you're free to be wrong.
Yeah, you are. And they're free to be wrong as well. You know, and this was one of those debates happening with the brethren in winter quarters and everything, saying, could a prophet be wrong? They say, well, that's why seven members of the Quorum of the Twelve should be able to override what the prophet says. That was Orson Pratt's argument. And they voted in terms of, no, the prophet needs to be the mouthpiece of the Lord. Well, that's interesting that they're going to get different answers. What do we do? Yeah.
About the children, you have to teach the children on the level they are. You can't go in and teach primary children
right.
that, yeah, follow the prophet, but
he might make mistakes.
But as the kids get older, you can gradually ease that in.
I don't think we do.
But
I'm saying, I think institutionally, that's one of our problems. That, like, for instance, we teach children that when they go down into the water, they're going to come up clean. Okay. Is that true? No, it's not. The water doesn't do anything. That's the sign. When does cleansing of sins come?
If it's done properly, you have been cleansed of sin before you're...
Oftentimes that happens.
That's what the doctrine
is. But because what is it that does the cleansing?
Repentance.
Well, it says it specifically. The Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost is the one you'll be cleansed by fire, right? Well, the problem is that we learn in primary that we're going to come up out of the water clean. And I don't necessarily disagree with starting with primary and saying they have an understanding that there's a cleansing process that happens as part of baptism. The problem is that we don't always update from what we learned in primary. So follow the prophets, but we never come back, I don't think, with youth or young adults and say, yes, sometimes prophets can make mistakes because we learned it in primary. And then they find out that Brigham Young said some of the things he did and their whole faith crumbles because they got historical information that blew them out of the water and broke their shelf. Okay, well, that's because we're not really geared up to update. And our lovely leaders that we love so much, their job is to be gatekeepers of the orthodoxy over the doctrine, right? There you go.
So I would be very hesitant.
Yeah. Yes.
To try to update them and have them go tell their parents that, Brother Manager just said that the prophets might be wrong.
Yes.
And
because that's why I say there is some institutional pushback. Right. And we're going to find out that this exact thing is why it is that the priesthood ban lasted for over 100 years. Because each successive leader was unwilling to push back and paint the prophet before as maybe having had less light than they now had. So let me take it one step farther. Let's say that Charlie, you've been in touch with a lot of missionary work going on. Let's say that you're teaching a black prospective member. At what point do you bring up the priesthood ban during the missionary lessons?
Well, you just keep it quiet.
Yes. And then what? Then they get baptized. And then they get baptized. And then what happens? I'm a Mormon. I'm going to go on Google. Hey, I'm a Mormon. Ah!
If you're teaching an alcoholic, when you preach, teach them the word of wisdom.
See, we're more comfortable with that. That's right, because we go, it's word of wisdom, that makes sense. But I don't think there's anything in the standard before baptism, is there, that says we're going to teach everybody that there was a priesthood ban. I don't think even plural marriage comes up in the standard missionary lessons, does it? Okay, yeah.
To me, blacks being banned
from the matter.
But the shameful doctrinal. Not righteous. So it's always.
Hold on to that one.
It's always the junk to that.
Yeah.
Because you know that's going to complicate their lives. But it's shameful when you call them.
Do you know what? If I could go back and rename this class, the junk we add would probably be the best framing I could think of calling this. That it is the junk we add. Yeah.
Ohio, the Lord says, I'm going to give you commandments.
Uh huh.
42, it talks about one
life. Yeah. Jacob 2 says that. Yeah. I think it is the junk we add. You know, there is, if we're trying to find a way to explain sometimes the revelations or inspiration that's come and then be able to say, what are the circumstances? There are going to be some of these that are going to go on, we say, on the shelf. We just don't have any answers. Like, I don't have any understanding why it is we don't have more information on Mother in Heaven. I wish we did. But it's stuff on the shelf. And some of the background behind plural marriage is there. But with the priesthood ban, guys, with the stuff that we've gotten, let me start going through some of this, and you're gonna say, oh, we figured out exactly where a lot of this stuff is coming from. We have more information and light. And as Bruce R. McConkie's gonna say, and we'll talk about this next week, he's gonna say that greater light and knowledge came from the revelation than previous leaders had. He's saying they were operating with less light. But then they added junk to it, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that missionary zeal and that drive, I think that's a really good point. It's like, we just don't want to bring the problematic stuff up because we're going to, but it bites us. There's a reason why it is that people come in the front door and then leave out the back door when they start finding the stuff that the missionaries didn't tell them. Okay, just Google sometimes. And just say, what do Mormon missionaries not tell you? There's a whole list of things that, okay, so, all right, so that's it. So let's slide into this a little bit, and then you can kind of see how much we answer this. Yeah. Yeah, because it's. Yeah,
I think that's a
good question.
Because I don't have an answer to that. And to me, the Lord finally looked down and said, okay, you're building all these temples, think about this.
Yeah.
And I think the Lord finally, that's my question.
Okay, well, boy, you're going to love next week. Okay, so let's really back up. Way back for just a sec, okay? If I were going to ask you what supersessionism means, anybody have anybody know what supersessionism is? A really fancy academic term. Okay?
I know.
All right. Here's supersessionism. What it basically says is that according to the Old Testament, that the Jews were the chosen people, that God gave them promises through Abraham that they were going to be the blessed people among all nations of the earth. That's who the Jews are. Then supersessionism is something that comes in the middle centuries that says when the Jews rejected Jesus, they lost that chosen status. And now the chosen people are who? Christians. If you accept Christ, you are now part of the chosen people. That is supersessionism, that Christianity and Christians, and particularly European Christians, particularly white European Christians, were the successor to all of the promises made to the Jews. Okay? And that's going to play a big role in just a second. So how far does that go? This is the coronation chair that was in England for a long time. Okay, still there. And but sitting underneath that is called the Stone of Scoon. Okay, anybody know what the Stone of Scoon is? I say it that way because Scotland borrowed it for a few hundred years and then they went up and got it and brought it back. But it was the Stone of Scoon. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so what was the purpose of the Stone of Scoon?
If you were being anointed the king, you sat on the stone, and it was part of the ceremony.
Right, so it is part of that ceremony, and they're always coronated. And so Charles was, Elizabeth was, they were all coronated on top of the Stone of Scoon. You go, girl.
When Jacob wrestled with the angel.
Yep. Yeah, here's the tradition. And then he puts it up as a pillar. And in the song, we call that the Ebenezer. Okay. And that means that's going to be the pillar to God and that covenant back to Jacob and the tribes of Israel. Okay. See where we're going with this? Yeah. And the tradition was then that when we talk about the fall of Israel is taken into exile at the time of Lehi, and we're talking about that Mulek is going to come to the promised land. The tradition is there's another brother, and he is brought to Ireland by Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is going to bring the covenant blood of the king of the kings of Jewishness, the Jews, bring them to Ireland. And so if you look at the Irish flag, guess what? It has on it a harp. There's a little harp on it. That's the harp of David. Okay. Now with that, then there's also a tradition that then traces the Stone of Scoon through the Germanic tribes to the Anglo-Saxons that then brings them to England. And so in this ceremony, and part of why I wanted to show this is Queen Elizabeth. They're bringing a canopy, and she will be coronated queen. They'll draw a veil over her, and then she will be anointed with oil from Jerusalem to be queen, and she then becomes the successor of who? And Abraham. Now we're all the way back to the kings of David. So in other words, the tradition is that the kings and queens of England are the rightful heirs to the king of David. That's basically what that's okay. Yeah, in other words, you got to follow the line of succession. That's why there's always been a bit of a rift there that says who is entitled to this. And they say, well, this is coming from Peter, Jesus to Peter, And the Church of England is going, yeah, but we go back to King David. You know, but we're still claiming a right, but you have to follow a bloodline. There has to be a bloodline that traces itself. And that bloodline can't be unsullied. It has to be pure. Right? Pure.
Pure?
Yeah, it's got to be. It's got to. You don't want it anything to impact it. Right.
No,
I know.
Norman invaders.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, but the only problem with that is because of Henry VIII separating from the Catholic Church.
Right.
And they became Protestant.
Right.
When they came up through the line, they didn't want anyone to become a king or whatever that was maybe Catholic. So they went away from, because some of the ones were still Catholic.
Yeah.
And so they decided, well, we're not going to put in, you know, you, because yes, you are come from our blood, but since you're Catholic, we don't want you. And they went to the German and brought in a German
who can track
to come back and do the line, because he was not Catholic.
Yeah, now,
and they wanted to break away from the Catholic.
Now remember, guys, a lot of this is not as much about logic as much as it is about tradition and believing we added the junk. Okay? So it's going to be, this is what we believe, even though sometimes the details get messy and you might need an explanation. But we need you to know that the new pope or the new king in England has tracings back to Christ or back to King David traditionally, even though you can find a lot of problems with that. Yeah. That's a good question. It was Salem under Melchizedek, you know, drew Salem. I don't know. You'll have to do the research and let us know. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah.
There's a real small movement. Scottish college students have developed a decided that not being heavy anymore.
Right.
It should be in Scotland.
It should be in Scotland.
And
that's right.
They
stole the stone of Scone.
They stole it, brought it back to Scotland. They were folk heroes. Everybody was cheering. The British didn't take a very good view of it. The rest of them never served any time in jail. And also the students managed to break it in half.
Yeah, that put back to Europe.
But it didn't get taken back to England there, and now it's back in Scotland. It's a clearer chance to see the
But remember, part of all of this is about trying to claim lineage and a right to a lineage. Does that make sense? Okay, so all right, so we are immune from all of this in the church, right? When I was on my mission in England, part of what we were told over and over and over again was the fact that the believing blood, that is, that those that are going to be true Israelites will recognize us when we knock on their door. There is a believingness in certain bloodlines, and that what that means is, we had statistics, it's like you will get one convert for every 10,000 doors that you knock on. So the faster you get through 10,000 doors, the faster you get your convert. But that means that all the rest of them are not the believing blood of Israel, and they will not recognize, the Spirit won't stir within them. But the believing Ephraimites will. So when I'm in England, we've got visits by Bernard Brockbank, Marky Peterson, Bruce R. McConkie, and they're all saying the same thing. England is the believing blood. They will recognize the... And they are the ones, and we've had a great harvest into the church of the believing blood, and they brought that belief with them. And how do we know? Well, everybody that we have, we give patriarchal blessings to in England, guess what? They're all Ephraim. So it's all proof that there's believing blood, because some tribes are going to be more believing than others.
Enthusiastic and he
was Reuben or something.
Right, you know. And then they got their patriarchal blessings, and then when he got his patriarchal blessings, he all of a sudden became very enthusiastic about the church. And so they went to the church, the bishop or state president, saying, "What's the difference? Oh, well, you're part of the believing blood," and he was adopted. And as soon as he was adopted, then that's when.
Yeah, and so Joseph's spin on this was the fact that he believed that if you joined the church and you weren't of one of the 12 tribes, your blood would change, meaning your lineage would change. And that was one of those things that he postulated out there, okay? Because we're still going back to the idea that there is power in a bloodline, and you can't sully the bloodline. I keep saying that, right? Because that's gonna have an impact on where we're going here. You can't sully the bloodline. And so there was an old gentleman, this was actually in conference. Faith is part of our heritage. Those who embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ are the blood of Israel, and the characteristic of the house of Israel is the ability to believe. Okay, how often have you heard lately in general conference talking about the believing blood? How often do you think they're going to go into Africa and let's talk about the believing blood of Israel? It's one of those, but it's one of those traditional things that was in the church. It was junk we added that just got added into the whole mix of the dough of what we're mixing this, okay? All right. So, but look it up. It is in Mormon doctrine, right?
Well, we just sang Come O Thou King of Kings for the second time in a month. We've got black members in our congregation, and you know, I think that hymn should be removed from our hymn book. Hopefully, it will be soon.
So some things are going to be.
But it's only because Bruce McConkie put about the chosen race in there.
He did. I know.
But he's also tricky enough to get 8 verses into a 4-verse song. And people can only.
I know. All right. So as long as you have that. Now, by the way, so much of this, think about this is the Christianity. This is the culture in which the first generations of the church swam in. This is what they grew up with. This is what they heard. They were marinated in supersessionism. Okay? So now, let's roll on here. Joseph Smith, in his time, he is going to, as they are offering the priesthood, they're going to begin to offer there are going to be some, especially free black men and women that are joining the church. And the question is, are we going to have any question about ordaining them? And they don't, under Joseph Smith. First one is Elijah Abel. Elijah Abel will join the church. He will hear the gospel in Ohio. Elijah will come to Kirtland. He will be ordained to the priesthood in January of 1836, when they're doing washing and anointings in the School of the Prophets. Elijah Abel is there. He receives his washing and anointings. He gets a patriarchal blessing from Joseph Smith Sr., who says, "You have been ordained an elder in the priesthood." And he is part of the second quorum of, well, not second quorum. Back then they had local 70s quorums. They weren't general. But he was part of the second quorum of 70, and he was till the day he died. Okay, so we know that he received the gospel early. Elijah Abel's one of my heroes. Jane Manning James. We're going to talk about her in a few minutes. I have a very hard time with Jane Manning. I have a real tender heart on a lot of this. They'd conquered it they'd dealt with it by then. Okay, but Jane Manning is Her family joins the church about 1841, 1842. She comes to Nauvoo. She is she's a single black woman. She will be invited into the Mansion House, the Smith household, and she will work there as a domestic servant, not as a slave servant, but as a domestic house person. And in 1844, Emma's going to approach her and say to her, Joseph and I would like to adopt you as a daughter. And she's like, well, in the temple. And she's like, well, that's kind of weird. I'm not sure. Emma will ask her again about 2 weeks later. And she says, I still don't understand this. No. Okay. But hang on to that story, because that's going to become a big issue in just a few minutes. But Jane Manning was loved by the Smiths. Okay. Q. Walker Lewis. Q. Walker is he's a barber in Lowell, Massachusetts. He will join the church in the early 40s. He is ordained an elder. He's active in the branch there. He's an abolitionist, and he has a prominent role in what's going on in Lowell, Massachusetts in the 1840s. Okay. And in fact, a black brother comes to winter quarters, William McCary, and we'll talk about him in a second. And he says, what about me being ordained? No, he says, the saints are giving me some heat here. Brigham Young says, no, you're welcome, regardless of the color of your skin. In fact, one of our best elders is actually back in Lowell, Massachusetts. And he's talking about Q. Walker Lewis. Okay, Q. Walker will be a mainstay of that branch until his death. He never comes out to Salt Lake, but that Q. Walker. But that just some notables. But one of the things that we find in all of these is the fact that Joseph is ordaining blacks to the priesthood. He is embracing blacks into the church. He sees no difference, except for the fact, guys, if you are the most liberal-minded person in the United States at that time, most anti-slavery person you can imagine, you still believe very firmly in a certain principle, and that is, but even before that, it is you are equal but separate. Equal but separate. It needs to be separate. In fact, Joseph at one point, you remember part of his presidential campaign is going to be that we need to free all the slaves by selling public land and buy them off so they'll be free. But probably the best thing we could do is then put them on a boat and send them back to Africa, because we still don't believe in the mixing of races. And so, again, the most liberal people out there are still going to believe equal but separate. So think about even in the early 50s, 1950s, we were still saying, yeah, we're equal, but we're separate. So we need separate water fountains, restaurant, different places on the bus. And we love you and we're glad you're here. We just need to stay separate. Okay. Now, the most egregious part of that would be intermarriage. Okay, so hang on to that, because that's going to play a big role. But anyway, we know as under Joseph Smith, we don't have any, we have a number of records now attesting the fact, because even to the day he died, Elijah Abel had a preaching certificate still signed by Joseph Smith to say that he had a license to preach as an ordained elder in the church. Okay, now, so what happened? So what's going to occur here? There's going to be a couple of problems that arise out of all of this. Joseph dies, and they start to move forward. And even part of that, if you haven't had a chance to read it, or watch it. Molly Bonner did a great little movie called My Name is Greenflake. Anybody seen that? Cool. Yeah, Molly did a good job on that, I thought. And Greenflake was another freed slave. Oh, thank you. Another freed slave that was in Nauvoo, and he helped carve a path for the trek going forward. We get to winter quarters, and like I said, we have another man that's just shown up, William McCary. He's black, and he's trying to settle in with the Saints, but he just is not. He comes to the 12. This is after Brigham Young, just before Brigham Young's going to leave. It's March 1847. McCary's going to say, they're not treating me very well. That's when he's going to say, yeah, one of our best elders is there. You're fine. You're okay. So everybody needs to kind of chill a little bit. And so then they take off and they head out. And by the way, in the vanguard are three black men that will be some of the first men to actually enter the Great Basin will be black. But William McCary, after Brigham Young leaves, William McCary kind of goes off the reservation a little bit. First thing McCary will do is that he will marry a white woman, which would be fine except for the fact that he will then kind of declare himself a prophet. He will then start to take polygamous wives in some not good situations, bringing these wives in, teaching them. So he's practicing spiritual wivery. He kind of declares himself a prophet. And he's just stirring things up in winter quarters. When Brigham Young comes back from Salt Lake, now we get in, mid-fall, he find out everything that William McCary's been doing, and he's stirring it up. Ultimately, he will be excommunicated for everything that he's doing. But this is the first statement that we get, and I could have put it in here, I guess. When Parley Pratt, who then goes into the Salt Lake Valley, we talked last time that he's running late behind Brigham Young, so he gets his 1,500 saints into the valley, and then he follows back. So Parley Pratt then gets to winter quarters. Brigham Young is already there, and he's finding out that William McCary is having some impact on a number of people, as James Strange, who is kind of cherry-picking people and taking them off to Wisconsin. Parley Pratt's statement is this. He says, I can't believe that people are falling for this, so don't go wandering off with the Strangeites out in the wilderness or from some black man who can't even hold the priesthood due to the history of Cain. He's cursed. Can't hold the priesthood. Why are you going to follow him? With Parley Pratt, that's the first statement we get of tying his blackness to the curse of Cain. And it comes from Parley Pratt in December of 1847.
Noah.
Who said it first? Well, he's going to interpret that. In other words, it's his interpretation of
Noah not getting the priesthood.
Within the restored church. Okay. So they get that. This is sometimes called the twin pillars of what maybe nudged Brigham Young where he went. Okay. First one's William. Yeah. Unrighteousness, wickedness, sin. Yeah, it's not tied to skin color at all. Okay, but that's William McCary. Now, right behind that, though, they've got missionaries that are going out and trying to solicit money for the trek going west, and they will go out to Massachusetts. because there's some prosperous people in that little branch in Lowell, Massachusetts. And what they find is Q. Walker Lewis's son, Isaiah Lewis, has married a white woman, which was a little, we're not sure we like this, but horror of horrors, they had a baby. They don't go there, you know. So now this that is the ultimate. You're going to start having kids, and what you're now doing is sullying the bloodline, because all of the blessings of Christianity and all the blessings of Israel are going to somehow stop with that offspring. Now, by the way, remember, we've talked about that Brigham Young, and you'll see the term in there, and it's even in the census records. They are called, if you have an intermarriage like that, their child is going to be called a mulatto, meaning mule lotto. That's what mule lotto is. Can mules have kids? No. So there was a belief that if you intermarry, that they're going to be mulattoes, meaning they won't be able to have kids themselves, you know, which was weird because they were having kids, didn't stop them, or they would call them quadroons, meaning there is you of your four parents above you, one of those is going to be black, quadroons, but mulattoes are enough that. And Brigham Young is going to kind of be aware of this. So there's like these old traditions that says you're going to stop their ability to reproduce. But secondly, any cursing that goes with the black skin is going to pass on to those kids.
So I can understand
the
church where they
yeah. Well, but hold on. If you own a plantation and you have a child by one of your slaves, is that child going to be free or a slave?
They're mixed,
but they're still slaves.
And most of them were.
There
not,
wasn't an expectation they would be free.
Most of them were not recognized as mixed. Most of them, the plantation owner didn't say, "Oh yeah,
that's my kid." Okay. All right, so you've got that problem. So those are they're called the twin shocks of 1847. These two things happen, and they're going to have a major effect.
Still, till about 1950, it was illegal for a person that was an octoroon, that's 1/8 black,
right,
to marry a white person in places in the United States.
Sure. Well, in fact, remember the 13 original colonies of the United States all had laws against intermarriage. It was like $1,000 fine and some jail time if you married somebody of the other race.
I just think it's fascinating. I keep seeing this phrase in my head, another tangent that I am looking at, is further light and knowledge. Because I watch Finding Your Roots on
PBS. Yeah, oh, that's good.
Right. You know,
yes.
From the
I know.
Except maybe. I kept trying to find my black roots.
Yeah. They're not there. Yeah.
But it's just fascinating because we're here and they're working with knowledge and it's coming from cultural, traditional.
It's true.
We have our own. Isn't it just no wonder they talk about fullness of time?
Yeah, that we needed more light than what we had. Yeah, well, but they were operating again with what they had, which oftentimes they added junk. Yeah.
Just a matter of interest, when I was in Williamsburg, Virginia, one of the things that I learned there is this was before the Revolutionary War.
Right.
There was a child born of a, you know, white guy and, you know, black. And she sued that heritage through the father and the mother were, you know, patriarchal society, and I
right.
should have the same rights as my father. the laws agreed with her and gave her that, then they changed the laws so that wouldn't happen again.
Oh, wow.
And then they were all labeled as, you know, slaves afterwards. They couldn't claim the rights of the father anymore. But they changed the law because of that. But it did happen.
Which is interesting, because if you're trying to claim Jewish heritage and a right to, in Israel, it's through the mother. I don't know. I saw something on one of, was it Judge Judy or something like that, that there was a lady saying, well, I don't know who the father is, but how do we know who the mother is?
Well, I think with IVF, that's a reasonable argument.
Well, that's true. That's true.
So what are they, how do they, and even how do we deal with the concept of Adam and Eve? I mean, were Adam and Eve, was there a black Adam and Eve and a Chinese Adam and Eve?
Well, see, that's part of the mystery of the whole thing, isn't it? It is. Okay. Now, by the way, there was one other little piece that I would add that happens right in here, and that is in Virginia. Virginia, prior to the Civil War, comes up with what they call the one-drop policy. How do you know how much black is black? And so what they come up with is the one-drop policy that says if you have one drop of black blood in your ancestry, you're black. I know. We're not talking logic, we're talking tradition.
Well, that is factors. My understanding is that one of the major factors in Revelation
79
there were so many baptisms in
Brazil.
They couldn't tell who was black.
That's right. They were doing a quantum test and it was a mess. So yeah, hold on to that. Because that's where we're going next week. We're going to go into what happens to. Okay, so have that in mind. They're going to go out to Utah. These things have happened. There's the one drop thing in there, and Parley Pratt is introducing the idea that we're going to tie black skin back to Cain. Okay, now, so we're going to get so here's the problem. Then we get to Utah, and in 1852. Utah has this, is going to be accepted into the United States as a territory. But at that time, prior to the Civil War, each territory or state is going to come up either it's going to be free or it's going to be slave. Don't know which. That's why Missouri was slave by the Missouri Compromise. It was a slave state when the members were there in Missouri. Okay, well, Utah's coming in, and the question is, are we going to be admitted into the Union as slave or free? And we're going to go down to the territorial state house in Fillmore and argue this fact. And what's going to happen here is that there's going to be days of arguing in January of 1852 about what we're going to do. And so for a long time, we knew that there were some decisions that came out of this legislative session, but there was a brother, Watson, I've got his name, I'll show you a sec. Anyway, he took detailed notes in Pittman shorthand, where they could actually, my mom could read Pittman shorthand.
My mom could write it and read it.
Yeah, it was one of the, if you're going to be a secretary at all, you learn Pittman shorthand. And they go back, and they were doing that. So we have had for years, we have had these stacks of documents that gave detailed word-for-word discussions and translations, transcriptions of what was said in this legislative session. And they were never transcribed. Okay? They just sat there. We heard decisions that came out of there. We didn't have the details. Okay? Then in 2015, Matthew Harris and a couple of others were trying to do the research on this, and they found somebody that could still read Pittman. And so they were able to get permission from the church to pull out all these transcripts. And so for the first time in a long time, in 2015, we finally got the word-for-word transcript of what happened in January 1852. Okay, so we now have this. And hopefully I'll be able to, oh, this is always good. Let me do this. I'll show it to you. Here it is. Okay. Okay, trust me. Trust me. Okay. I don't know if I can.
I'm a firm believer in slavery. I think it is reasonable according to the revelation. Now the case before us.
Okay, there it is. Okay. This is Brigham Young. He says, I have this section in my hand, and it was called the Act in Regard to Slaves, and he's going to change it to Act in Regards to Service. I have this section in my hand. I've been reading over it. Now, this is Brigham at the pulpit there in the courthouse. Little alteration. First, with regards to slavery, I believe in the Bible in so much as I believe in the ordinances as much as I believe in the ordinances of the God and the priesthood order, I believe in slavery. As far as this act is concerned, we're going to make African creature amenable to certain laws. In their freedom, they have subjected themselves to cursing. Okay, this is hard. This is hard, guys. In their families, in their classes, in their various capacities, they have brought curses upon them until the curse is removed by him who put the curse. On this class, I am not authorized to remove. Remove it. I'm a firm believer in slavery. I believe it's reasonable according to the revelations. So he's off and running. What, oh dear, yes.
What changed his stance lately from how it was acting earlier?
That is the big question. That's why we think that there was two things that happened. That's why 1847 with William McCary and with Q. Walker Lewis's son. Had a fact. I think there were just a number of factors, but that is the question everybody keeps asking. This is January 1852. Now remember, this is the first time that doctrinally this is being saying in the church, but this isn't being said in general conference. This is being said in a legislative session. He was. Now the case before us pertaining to slaves, I am for making laws just as the laws we want. We're independent of every other nation. And so we can basically kind of do what we want to do here. He's going to make the case for, and I think he starts it over here. Yeah, there's another couple of problems. You're asking what changed his mind. Part of it is the fact that we have men in this valley that they've been out preaching the gospel in the South, and in the South they're bringing their slaves with them, who brought slaves with them, and we've had those that have come here and left. They came here in good faith with their slaves, believing that they wouldn't lose their slaves. Okay? Now it's an interesting thing here. He's going to say, they, black Africans, enjoy the rights of receiving the first principles of the gospel. These servants enjoy the privilege of being baptized, the privilege of living before the Lord, before their masters and before their friends, to enjoy the spirit of the Lord as the comforts of light and knowledge and everything are concerned. The blacks have the same priesthood as white men, except they just can't hold the priesthood. Well, that's the first time that's ever been elucidated like that. They can't hold the priesthood. Insomuch they cannot share in the priesthood, I ask, can they bear the rule in any other place until the curse is removed? Consequently, they are a servant of servants. Okay. And then, yeah, they're going to get some biblical, whoops. He's going to make an interesting case. He's going to say the enlightened country of England abolished slavery. However, they have debtor slaves. They have indentured servants that live in poorer conditions than our African slaves that are picking cotton. They get fed. Their masters make sure that they're okay. But the debtors in England are worse slaves off than our, you know, you just hear some of the explanations here, okay? Many in the South have vested in slaves. These are their servants want to come here. But when they come, the devil is raised. One is talking. It prevails on them and stuff like that. Now, how are you going to justify this? Well, now we get the doctrinal spin. The Lord God has said, cursed be old Cain. And God has said that only after the last drop of Abel receives the priesthood and enjoys the blessings of it, then Cain is calculated to have his share, but not until then. Consequently, I am firmly in my belief of servitude. Okay, how you doing?
Did the Bible even say that Abel ever had children?
No. They're making it up. That's why I'm saying junk enters in. And so there is a justification behind this. Now, as he's preaching this, what we have, and I could put this, I don't have this at the moment.
It's a justification.
Yeah, there's going to be two justifications. This is the first one. Okay. Now, right after him will come Orson Pratt. Because what he's saying is, because of this, Utah should enter the U.S. Union as a slave state. That's what he's saying.
But we notice nothing in here that isn't an academic argument or a feelings argument. There's no, thus saith the Lord.
No, there isn't. And in fact, part of what he will say in another speech close to this, he will say, if Noah, he's going to acknowledge this, if no other prophet has ever preached this, I will. What he's basically saying is, no other prophet has ever preached this, meaning Joseph Smith, but I am now preaching this, that they're not going to get the priesthood. It's my call. And he's very clear about the fact, it's my call, it's my decision. I think both are there. I think he is a prophet, but he's a man of his time. And I think it's going to be not Spencer Kimball. It's going to be Boyd K. Packer is going to say Brigham Young spoke with less light than we now have. Bruce R. McConkie will say the same thing. Okay. Now, yeah, everything I've ever said on this is wrong. Okay. Now, what's going to happen right after this? Orson Pratt's going to get up, and he's going to rip. He is adamantly against this. How can we do this? How can we allow this to happen? We have an opportunity to abolish slavery now. Why are we doing this? And then he says, if we do this, angels will blush. Angels will blush. Yeah. Because it's like, guys, why are we doing this? And he battles this thing loud and long. And what'll happen at the end of this here is that they will end up voting, and Utah will be entered into the Union for 10 years as a slave state. Well, sort of. Okay. But here, right. You got splaining to do? Okay. All right. So here is, let me tell you, I was of the same, I'm basically the same opinion. Yeah. Yeah. He'd done some missions in the north in England, but he hadn't been to the south. No. No, he doesn't. Yeah. I know. I know.
And go to a slave market. You know, auction.
Yeah, and just see how horrific. Yeah, I don't want to offend these guys that are bringing their money and their, but.
I think anybody who has access.
Yeah, would have a hard time with it. Yeah. And we did. And we did. Well, and that's, see, this is the very, this was the nightmare scenario that Orson Pratt dreamed of when they were reconstituting the first presidency, that the prophet could make a unilateral decision and the rest of the 12 couldn't offset that. This was the exact special case that he was thinking about. Something like this could happen, and it did. And it's the one case against a first presidency without having a quorum of the 12.
But
check and balance.
But there's no indication that the 12 would have changed it if they could.
We don't know. We know Orson did. We know Parley did. But what did they have a quorum? I don't know. Yeah.
Are there any political advantage to implementing this?
Absolutely.
The state was going to be part of the U.S.
Right.
They weren't going to be admitted as a free state.
But it also gave them some political power because New Mexico had just come in free. So if we come in slave, we maintain that balance and we're more likely to get the support of the Southern senators stuff. This is pre-Civil War. So there was a big political advantage. Good point. Yeah. Yeah.
This is a little different, a different time, but I ran across a wrinkle kind of history in David O. McKay's journal.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well,
there was a bishop in South Africa.
Yep.
That had
mission president.
It was a mission president.
Yeah.
Thoughts are vague on this. He said we have some very, very
we have some problems.
Members,
yeah.
And they're faithful, and it just hurts me to see their children sitting out in the audience not being able to fast the sacrament.
Yeah.
And David O. McKay sent back a message, ordain them. Go ahead and go ordain them. And they did.
Yeah, well, hold on to that. We're going to talk about that next week because David O. McKay is going to play a big role here.
Read that stuff by Brigham Young, we all tend to sort of bristle.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking back, I think the first time I heard the blacks and all of you, think back the first time you were a kid. What was your reaction?
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, well, okay. I mean, I didn't say, oh, that's terrible.
That's the way we do it, and I just said it is. I know.
But nevertheless,
sometimes there's an institutional belief that things that we look at. I do that same thing with in First Nephi when it's like, oh, Nephi is going to chop off the head of a defenseless guy. Okay, and Spirit says it's okay to kill a defenseless person like that. You know, without thinking, is there any other options? No. He's like, that's just the way it was. You know, sometimes we accept things without asking questions, and I think this is one of them. Yeah. So was Orson Pratt.
Was the Lord subject to
mankind? That is, and you know what? And that is one of the next questions that needs to come because. If the Lord immediately intervened in prophets' mistakes, would the 116 pages have gotten lost? No. Would the Kirtland Bank Society Safety Society have fallen? No. Would we have done the temple endowment ceiling wrong for 50 years? No. Would this priesthood ban have happened? No. It was, and they were pulling on doctrine to do it, but the Lord still could have said, come and visited Brigham Young and said, this isn't doctrine, don't do this. So part of what we have to wrestle with, and I think it's going to be in the aftermath, probably more next week, is that the Lord is going to allow prophets to be people of their time. They're going to make decisions. And then some of those are going to be inaccurate, and the Lord's going to give them some leeway for some period of time without the church being led astray.
Brigham Young considered Adam God.
And he believed Adam God. And President Monson brought in the pox of, you know, we're not going to baptize the children of same-sex marriages. And then 18 months later, they went, okay, no, we're changing that. Quietly. They make mistakes, get made. Yeah. Yeah.
So then you're going to talk about that next week. How much have we made known?
Yeah, you know, I think there was a hope. Like we just hosted a beautiful fireside with Molly Bonner, and we had the local NAACP, and we love those guys, and we're doing a lot of work with those. And part of it is being led by President Nelson working with the national NAACP and all of those settings. And I think there's some of us that really kind of hope would have been a great place to apologize. And we just haven't. And for whatever reason, we haven't. Maybe it's legal. I don't know.
But your errors being made known doesn't have to be a big public flourish. I mean, as soon as you realize you're doing something wrong, you know about it. Your error has been made known, and then you change what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, and that's why the closest we got to it is Bruce R. McConkie in August of 1980.
Of two, somebody apologizing for their mistake.
Yeah, that he stood up in 78 and says, everything I've ever said is wrong. Everything ever, all the leaders have said it has been wrong. But that apology to the black population seems like it would be something that would be helpful. And the church hasn't yet. And will they? I don't know. Probably not. Well, yes. Well, and part of what we're saying is this wasn't God's will. This wasn't God's will. And Brigham Young is saying, I made mistakes. This wasn't God's will. This was my call. Now, I'm going to do it based on a doctrinal understanding. Now, let me take it just one step farther, because Orson Pratt is a hero, but he's got one problem. And I know. So in 1852, he's going to say, angels will blush, don't do this and everything. Then the church is going to move forward. Now the deal. So how do we explain then that if Joseph Smith was doing it, was ordaining them, and there's some curse, and I'm not sure that I like the curse, somehow they're being cursed. Where did the curse start? And it's going to be Orson Pratt that's going to say, there is the pre-existence. So maybe then that means that they were less valiant in the pre-existence, and that explains why they're being born into black bodies. So now we get the second justification. They're born through the lineage of Cain, but probably it was okay because they were less valiant in the pre-existence, so that they came in, that's how. And so Orson Pratt, of all people, is going to be the one that first comes up with that little hummer. Okay, yeah.
I don't know. Anytime anybody let's go home and pray about it.
I don't know, but there is a sense of, oh, it's almost like a group think. I think this is going to make sense. We're going to do this. And that's why, so, oh,
this would have been a very difficult thing.
Wouldn't it though?
Really, really difficult. They want to be a part of the United States
territory. Yes.
Because for their obvious advantage, all the trouble they've
right.
had so far.
Yeah. Right.
And then you've got all this thinking. The whole country was a mess like that.
Mm-hmm.
In my own family, my mother was Kentucky, a border state. And the way she would describe
describe things, I thought before I did genealogy that they were fought for the Confederacy. Your family didn't. They fought for the
Yeah.
And it, the whole country was, it was...
It was a mess.
It was a mess.
It was a mess.
But the only way I think you could really get it, Lord, want me to
do. Yeah, I know. Okay, so let me give one last thing here, and then we'll be done. Like I said, there's a lot of information here, and we'll continue this next week, and including the wonderful revelatory resolution of this problem. And that is in 1879, this is kind of where it gets codified just a little bit more. 1879, Elijah Abel's going to wait till Brigham Young dies. And then he's going to go to John Taylor. And he's going to say, I would like to go to the temple. We're about to build the temple in St. George is about done. I want to go. And he brings with him his letter, his license to preach, his patriarchal blessing. He's got all the things that says, I am legit. And I've been in the second quorum of 70 for a long time. And so John Taylor... is going to be very careful about this, and he's going to send Joseph F. Smith down to Provo to talk to Abraham Smoot, who was one of the last remaining people that had really kind of run around with Joseph Smith and was aware of some of the things here. And we know Abraham Smoot from, he's the Smoot building, the administration building at BYU is named after the Smoot building. So he's going to go down and talk to Abraham Smoot. Joseph F. is going to go down and say, you remember Elijah Abel? Yeah. Was he ever ordained? And Abraham Smoot says, nah, he was never ordained. And Joseph Smith was against ordaining black people. Doesn't help that Smoot was a slave owner. But anyway, so he's going to go down and talk to him. He's going to, but to Joseph F.'s going to come back to John Taylor, and he's going to go, I talked to Smoot, and I talked to a couple of other people. I think his memory's wrong. I don't believe it. And he's going to come back and tell John Taylor, I think that Elijah Abel's ordination was legitimate. And I would err on the side of letting him go to the temple. And John Taylor will pray about it with and come back and say, we think he was ordained. We're going to agree with that Smoot is wrong. But to send him to the temple would overturn past precedent. Literally past precedent. we'll then be going against Brigham Young. So we're going to say no. And then we're going to send him on a mission. And Elijah Abel will then take it. He will then go on a mission. He won't last very long in Ohio. He comes back and he dies shortly after. Okay, that's the tragedy of this. I know, it's killer. Ugh, it just hurts me. Just a little bit of a teaser for next week. Joseph F. is going to also be involved in some petitions coming from Jane Manning James during this period of time. And in 1904, he's going to remember his history differently. Joseph F. is going to have a memory lapse. And he won't remember what it is that he said earlier, 30 years later. So it's tough. There's some tough history here. All right, so let me just leave it with this, because I think that what comes out of here is a number of, it's not just this is our history, but there's a number of questions that roll out of here, because we still love and revere Brigham Young as a prophet. I think he was inspired. I think he was the man for the times. I think he needed to lead the church at that point, and I still love his writings, and I still revere him as a prophet. And I still see the mistakes that he made as the error of his times, the additional light he didn't have, mistakes that he made. And sometimes that's reassuring to me to say, okay, I can make a bunch of mistakes and still be able to serve well and to be able to be inspired on certain things. I don't have to be perfect to do that. Did this lead the church astray? No, I don't think it led the church astray, but it just caused us endless pain and incredible pain for the people that were involved in this. And it set us back a century in terms of our the gospel, taking the gospel to African-American descendants. And so I think it comes back to that question. Why wouldn't the Lord intervene? He doesn't, apparently. But at some point, we're going to figure out with Spencer Kimball. Spencer Kimball will give us an answer as to why he got an answer and other prophets didn't. There's some really nice quotes from his son's writing on this, Edward Kimball. So, how you feel? Doing all right? This is tough stuff. This isn't like fun stuff in the Grove and, you know, the translating the Book of Mormon. This is our hard history. Yeah.
I served in South Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our instruction was that if we knocked on the door of a black family, we could go in, share a spiritual message, a blessing upon them, but we could not continue to talk like
that. Right.
That was my companion and I. Walking down the sidewalk, knowing that they would join the church if we could.
Yeah.
It broke our hearts.
Yeah.
Later, when I was home, Revelation came out. My first response was, "Hallelujah, you know, we're ready to celebrate because this was terrific." My second thought was, "I couldn't have done this 10 years earlier, so I could have taught."
I have a similar experience that I'll share with you next week, because I came back just 4 months before the revelation and spent Christmas Day with a black family that I loved more than anything that wouldn't join because of this. So I think we have experiences that tell us that some of this is hard doctrine, and it's a hard experience, maybe not doctrine, but I just think that ultimately it's one of those wrestles that we make, and we have to be able to explain it well to people to be able to say this hurts us as much as anything, because this is just doesn't feel right, especially in our present understanding.
I think it's important for us to, if we have to forgive.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I wanted Larry here, and I'm hoping that Larry can make it here next week, because he's just a beautiful soul. And so, anyway, bury my testimony that the Lord has always been in this, and is going to, the Lord that understands the eternal arc of everything, that there's going to be nobody in the eternities that loses their exaltation because of the weaknesses of men on this earth. That doesn't mean that there isn't sometimes painful traumas and things and mistakes by leaders that maybe hurt us for a season, but still are inspired men that we can love and follow. But I love the idea. I just finished with this. I heard someone say the other day that when somebody is called to a calling and we say that we're sustaining them, that really means two things. That doesn't mean we think they're blameless. When we sustain them, it means I sustain, A, the process of calling somebody, bringing somebody imperfect into a calling, asking them to do a hard thing. And number two, sustaining means to hold them up, which means it's our job to help imperfect leaders in their decision-making. I work every day with bishops that struggle around a number of issues like pornography, and I'm on the phone talking to bishops where we talk about how is the best way to approach this young man that wants to go on a mission. And you've got some beliefs about things. Can I talk to you? And can I sustain you and hopefully change your thoughts and approach on something? And almost every time I've talked to bishops, they're like, okay, I see your point. We can do this. And in one case, I talked to this sweet bishop that was holding up this boy from getting ordained and stuff like that. And after we talked, he ordained him the next week. Just immediately, just because I see where his heart is, I see what he's trying to do, and he needs the blessings of all of this to help him overcome a very difficult problem. So, bearing my testimony, church is true, leaders are inspired, and they're human. And maybe that's, and I'll leave that with you in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Alan, can we call you for a little prayer?
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.